Disc 5.
Chapter 40. Outside Node 3, Chartrukian looked desperate. He was trying to convince Hale that Translator was in trouble. Susan raced by them with only one thought in mind, to find Strathmore. The panicked SysSec grabbed Susan's arm as she passed.
Miss Fletcher, we have a virus, I'm positive. You have to...
Susan shook herself free and glared ferociously. I thought the commander told you to go home.
But the run monitor, it's registering 18...
Commander Strathmore told you to go home.
Fuck Strathmore!
Chartrukian screamed, the words resounding through the dome. A deep voice boomed from above.
Mr. Chartrukian?
The three crypto employees froze. High above them, Strathmore stood at the railing outside his office. For a moment, the only sound inside the dome was the uneven hum of the generators below. Susan tried desperately to catch Strathmore's eye.
Commander, Hale is North Dakota.
But Strathmore was fixated on the young SysSec. He descended the stairs without so much as a blink, keeping his eyes trained on Chartrukian the whole way down. He made his way across the crypto floor and stopped 6 inches in front of the trembling technician.
What did you say?
Sir, Chartrukian choked. Translator's in trouble.
Commander, Susan interjected, if I could... Strathmore waved her off. His eyes never left the SysSec. Phil blurted,
We have an infected file, sir. I'm sure of it.
Strathmore's complexion turned a deep red.
Mr. Chartrukian, we've been through this. There is no file infecting Translator.
Yes, there is, he cried. And if it makes its way to the main data bank...
Where the hell is this infected file? Strathmore bellowed. Show it to me.
Chartrukian hesitated.
I can't.
Of course you can't. It doesn't exist.
Susan said, Commander, I must... Again Strathmore silenced her with an angry wave. Susan eyed Hale nervously. He seemed smug and detached.
It makes perfect sense, she thought. Hale wouldn't be worried about a virus. He knows what's really going on inside Translator.
Chartrukian was insistent.
The infected file exists, sir. But Gauntlet never picked it up.
If Gauntlet never picked it up, Strathmore fumed, then how the hell do you know it exists?
Chartrukian suddenly sounded more confident.
Mutation strings, sir. I ran a full analysis, and the probe turned up mutation strings.
Susan now understood why the SysSec was so concerned.
Mutation strings, she mused.
She knew mutation strings were programming sequences that corrupted data in extremely complex ways. They were very common in computer viruses, particularly viruses that altered large blocks of data. Of course, Susan also knew from Tancado's email that the mutation strings Chartrukian had seen were harmless, simply part of Digital Fortress. The SysSec went on.
When I first saw the strings, sir, I thought Gauntlet's filters had failed. But then I ran some tests and found out...
He paused, looking suddenly uneasy.
I found out that somebody manually bypassed Gauntlet.
The statement met with a sudden hush. Strathmore's face turned an even deeper shade of crimson. There was no doubt whom Chartrukian was accusing. Strathmore's terminal was the only one in crypto with clearance to bypass Gauntlet's filters. When Strathmore spoke, his voice was like ice.
Mr. Chartrukian, not that it is any concern of yours, but I bypassed Gauntlet.
He went on, his temper hovering near the boiling point.
As I told you earlier, I'm running a very advanced diagnostic. The mutation strings you see in Translator are part of that diagnostic. They are there because I put them there. Gauntlet refused to let me load the file, so I bypassed its filters.
Strathmore's eyes narrowed sharply at Chartrukian.
Now, will there be anything else before you go?
In a flash, it all clicked for Susan. When Strathmore had downloaded the encrypted Digital Fortress algorithm from the Internet and tried to run it through Translator, the mutation strings had tripped Gauntlet's filters. Desperate to know whether Digital Fortress was breakable, Strathmore decided to bypass the filters. Normally, bypassing Gauntlet was unthinkable. In this situation, however, there was no danger in sending Digital Fortress directly into Translator. The commander knew exactly what the file was and where it came from.
"With all due respect, sir," Chartrukian pressed, "I've never heard of a diagnostic that employs mutation..."
"Commander," Susan interjected, not able to wait another moment, "I really need to..." This time, her words were cut short by the sharp ring of Strathmore's cellular phone. The commander snatched up the receiver.
"What is it?" he barked.
Then he fell silent and listened to the caller. Susan forgot about Hale for an instant. She prayed the caller was David.
"Tell me he's okay," she thought. "Tell me he found the ring."
But Strathmore caught her eye and gave her a frown. It was not David. Susan felt her breath grow short. All she wanted to know was that the man she loved was safe. Strathmore, Susan knew, was impatient for other reasons. If David took much longer, the commander would have to send backup, NSA field agents. It was a gamble he had hoped to avoid.
"Commander," Chartrukian urged, "I really think we should check..."
"Hold on,"
Strathmore said, apologizing to his caller. He covered his mouthpiece and leveled a fiery stare at his young syssec.
"Mr. Chartrukian," he growled, "this discussion is over. You are to leave Crypto. Now. That's an order."
Chartrukian stood stunned.
"But, sir, mutation stri..."
"Now!"
Strathmore bellowed. Chartrukian stared a moment, speechless. Then he stormed off toward the syssec lab. Strathmore turned and eyed Hale with a puzzled look. Susan understood the commander's mystification. Hale had been quiet. Too quiet. Hale knew very well there was no such thing as a diagnostic that used mutation strings, much less one that could keep Translator busy 18 hours. And yet, Hale hadn't said a word. He appeared indifferent to the entire commotion. Strathmore was obviously wondering why. Susan had the answer.
"Commander," she said insistently, "if I could just speak..."
"In a minute," he interjected, still eyeing Hale quizzically. "I need to take this call."
With that, Strathmore turned on his heel and headed for his office. Susan opened her mouth, but the words stalled on the tip of her tongue.
"Hale is North Dakota."
She stood rigid, unable to breathe. She felt Hale staring at her. Susan turned. Hale stepped aside and swung his arm graciously toward the Node 3 door.
"After you, Sue."
Chapter 41. In a linen closet on the third floor of the Alfonso 13, a maid lay unconscious on the floor. The man with wire-rimmed glasses was replacing a hotel master key in her pocket. He had not sensed her scream when he struck her, but he had no way of knowing for sure. He had been deaf since he was 12. He reached to the battery pack on his belt with a certain kind of reverence. A gift from a client, the machine had given him new life. He could now receive his contracts anywhere in the world. All communications arrived instantaneously and untraceably. He was eager as he touched the switch. His glasses flickered to life. Once again, his fingers carved into the empty air and began clicking together. As always, he had recorded the names of his victims, a simple matter of searching a wallet or purse. The contacts on his fingers connected, and the letters appeared in the lens of his glasses like ghosts in the air. Subject: Rocio Eva Granada. Terminated. Subject: Hans Huber. Terminated. 3 stories below, David Becker paid his tab and wandered across the lobby, his half-finished drink in hand. He headed toward the hotel's open terrace for some fresh air. "In and out," he mused. Things hadn't panned out quite as he expected. He had a decision to make. Should he just give up and go back to the airport? A matter of national security. He swore under his breath. So why the hell had they sent a schoolteacher? Becker moved out of sight of the bartender and dumped the remaining drink in a potted jasmine. The vodka had made him lightheaded. Cheapest drunk in history, Susan often called him. After refilling the heavy crystal glass from a water fountain, Becker took a long swallow. He stretched a few times, trying to shake off the light haze that had settled over him. Then he set down his glass and walked across the lobby. As he passed the elevator, the doors slid open. There was a man inside. All Becker saw were thick, wire-rimmed glasses. The man raised a handkerchief to blow his nose. Becker smiled politely and moved on, out into the stifling civilian night. Chapter 42. Inside Node 3, Susan caught herself pacing frantically. She wished she'd exposed Hale when she'd had the chance. Hale sat at his terminal.
Stress is a killer, Sue. Something you want to get off your chest?
Susan forced herself to sit. She had thought Strathmore would be off the phone by now and returned to speak to her, but he was nowhere to be seen. Susan tried to keep calm. She gazed at her computer screen. The tracer was still running, for the second time. It was immaterial now. Susan knew whose address it would return. ghale@crypto.nsa.gov. Susan gazed up toward Strathmore's workstation and knew she couldn't wait any longer. It was time to interrupt the commander's phone call. She stood and headed for the door. Hale seemed suddenly uneasy, apparently noticing Susan's odd behavior. He strode quickly across the room and beat her to the door. He folded his arms and blocked her exit.
"Tell me what's going on," he demanded. "There's something going on here today. What is it?"
"Let me out," Susan said as evenly as possible, feeling a sudden twinge of danger.
"Come on," Hale pressed. "Strathmore practically fired Chartrukian for doing his job. What's going on inside Translator? We don't have any diagnostics that run 18 hours. That's bullshit, and you know it. Tell me what's going on."
Susan's eyes narrowed.
"You know damn well what's going on."
"Back off, Greg," she demanded. "I need to use the bathroom." Hale smirked. He waited a long moment, and then stepped aside.
"Sorry, Sue. Just flirting."
Susan pushed by him and left Node 3. As she passed the glass wall, she sensed Hale's eyes boring into her from the other side. Reluctantly, she circled toward the bathrooms. She would have to make a detour before visiting the commander. Greg Hale could suspect nothing. Chapter 43. A jaunty 45, Chad Brinkerhoff was well-pressed, well-groomed, and well-informed. His summer-weight suit, like his tan skin, showed not a wrinkle or hint of wear. His hair was thick, sandy blonde, and most importantly, all his own. His eyes were a brilliant blue, subtly enhanced by the miracle of tinted contact lenses. He surveyed the wood-paneled office around him and knew he had risen as far as he would rise in the NSA. He was on the 9th floor, Mahogany Row, Office 9A197, the directorial suite. It was a Saturday night, and Mahogany Row was all but deserted, its executives long gone, off enjoying whatever pastimes influential men enjoyed in their leisure. Although Brinkerhoff had always dreamed of a real post with the agency, he had somehow ended up as a personal aide, the official cul-de-sac of the political rat race. The fact that he worked side by side with the single most powerful man in American intelligence was little consolation. Brinkerhoff had graduated with honors from Andover and Williams, and yet here he was, middle-aged, with no real power, no real stake. He spent his days arranging someone else's calendar. There were definite benefits to being the director's personal aide. Brinkerhoff had a plush office in the directorial suite, full access to all the NSA departments, and a certain level of distinction that came from the company he kept. He ran errands for the highest echelons of power. Deep down, Brinkerhoff knew he was born to be a PA. Smart enough to take notes, handsome enough to give press conferences, and lazy enough to be content with it. The sticky sweet chime of his mantel clock accented the end of another day of his pathetic existence. Shit, he thought. 5 o'clock on a Saturday. What the hell am I doing here? Chad? A woman appeared in his doorway. Brinkerhoff looked up. It was Midge Milken, Fontaine's internal security analyst. She was 60, slightly heavy, and, much to the puzzlement of Brinkerhoff, quite appealing. A consummate flirt, and an ex-wife 3 times over, Midge prowled the 6-room directorial suite with a saucy authority. She was sharp, intuitive, worked ungodly hours, and was rumored to know more about the NSA's inner workings than God himself. Damn, Brinkerhoff thought, eyeing her in her gray cashmere dress. Either I'm getting older or she's looking younger. Weekly reports, she smiled, waving a fanfold of paper. You need to check the figures. Brinkerhoff eyed her body. Figures look good from here. Really, Chad, she laughed. I'm old enough to be your mother. Don't remind me, he thought. Midge strode in and sidled up to his desk. I'm on my way out, but the director wants these compiled by the time he gets back from South America. That's Monday, bright and early. She dropped the printouts in front of him. What am I, an accountant? No, hun, you're a cruise director. Thought you knew that. So what am I doing crunching numbers? She ruffled his hair. You wanted more responsibility. Here it is. He looked up at her sadly. Midge, I have no life. She tapped her finger on the paper. This is your life, Chad Brinkerhoff. She looked down at him and softened. Anything I can get you before I go? He eyed her pleadingly and rolled his aching neck. My shoulders are tight. Midge didn't bite. Take an aspirin. He pouted. No back rub? She shook her head. Cosmopolitan says 2/3 of back rubs end in sex. Brinkerhoff looked indignant. Ours never do. Precisely, she winked. That's the problem. Midge. Night, Chad. She headed for the door. You're leaving? You know I'd stay, Midge said, pausing in the doorway. But I do have some pride. I just can't see playing second fiddle, particularly to a teenager. My wife's not a teenager, Brinkerhoff defended. She just acts like one. Midge gave him a surprised look. I wasn't talking about your wife. She battered her eyes innocently. I was talking about Carmen. She spoke the name with a thick Puerto Rican accent. Brinkerhoff's voice cracked slightly. Who? Carmen? In food services? Brinkerhoff felt himself flush. Carmen Huerta was a 27-year-old pastry chef who worked in the NSA commissary. Brinkerhoff had enjoyed a number of presumably secret after-hours flings with her in the stockroom. She gave him a wicked wink. Remember, Chad? Big Brother knows all. Big Brother? Brinkerhoff gulped in disbelief. Big Brother watches the stockrooms, too? Big Brother, or Brother, as Midge often called it, was a Centrex 333 that sat in a small closet-like space off the suite's central room. Brother was Midge's whole world. It received data from 148 closed-circuit video cameras, 399 electronic doors, 377 phone taps, and 212 freestanding bugs in the NSA complex. The directors of the NSA had learned the hard way that 26,000 employees were not only a great asset, but a great liability. Every major security breach in the NSA's history had come from within. It was Midge's job as internal security analyst to watch everything that went on within the walls of the NSA, including, apparently, the commissary stockroom. Brinkerhoff stood to defend himself, but Midge was already on her way out. Hands above the desk, she called over her shoulder. No funny stuff after I go. The walls have eyes. Brinkerhoff sat and listened to the sound of her heels fading down the corridor. At least he knew Midge would never tell. She was not without her weaknesses. Midge had indulged in a few indiscretions of her own, mostly wandering back rubs with Brinkerhoff. His thoughts turned back to Carmen. He pictured her lissom body, those dark thighs, that AM radio she played full blast, hot San Juan salsa. He smiled. Maybe I'll drop by for a snack when I'm done. He opened the first printout. Crypto, production/expenditure. His mood immediately lightened. Midge had given him a freebie. The crypto report was always a piece of cake. Technically, he was supposed to compile the whole thing, but the only figure the director ever asked for was the MCD, the mean cost per decryption. The MCD represented the estimated amount it cost translator to break a single code. As long as the figure was below $1,000 per code, Fontaine didn't flinch. A grand a pop, Brinkerhoff chuckled. Our tax dollars at work. As he began plowing through the document and checking the daily MCDs, images of Carmen Huerta smearing herself with honey and confectioner's sugar began playing in his head. 30 seconds later, he was almost done. The crypto data was perfect, as always. But just before moving on to the next report, something caught his eye. At the bottom of the sheet, the last MCD was off. The figure was so large that it had carried over into the next column and made a mess of the page. Brinkerhoff stared at the figure in shock. 999,999,999. He gasped. $1 billion? The images of Carmen vanished. $1 billion code? Brinkerhoff sat there a minute, paralyzed. Then in a burst of panic, he raced out into the hallway. Midge! Come back! Chapter 44. Phil Chartroukian stood fuming in the SysSec lab. Strathmore's words echoed in his head. Leave now. That's an order. He kicked the trash can and swore in the empty lab. Diagnostic my ass. Since when does the deputy director bypass Gauntlet's filters? The SysSecs were well paid to protect the computer system at the NSA, and Chartroukian had learned that there were only two job requirements: be utterly brilliant and exhaustively paranoid. Hell, he cursed. This isn't paranoia. The fucking run monitor's reading 18 hours. It was a virus. Chartroukian could feel it. There was little doubt in his mind what was going on. Strathmore had made a mistake by bypassing Gauntlet's filters, and now he was trying to cover it up with some half-baked story about a diagnostic. Chartroukian wouldn't have been quite so edgy had Translator been the only concern. But it wasn't. Despite its appearance, the great decoding beast was by no means an island. Although the cryptographers believed Gauntlet was constructed for the sole purpose of protecting their code-breaking masterpiece, the SysSecs understood the truth. The Gauntlet filters served a much higher god, the NSA's main databank. The history behind the databank's construction had always fascinated Chartroukian. Despite the efforts of the Department of Defense to keep the Internet to themselves in the late 1970s, it was too useful a tool not to attract the public sector. Eventually, universities pried their way on. Shortly after that came the commercial servers. The floodgates opened, and the public poured in. By the early 90s, the government's once secure Internet was a congested wasteland of public email and cyber porn. Following a number of unpublicized yet highly damaging computer infiltrations at the Office of Naval Intelligence, it became increasingly clear that government secrets were no longer safe on computers connected to the burgeoning Internet. The President, in conjunction with the Department of Defense, passed a classified decree that would fund a new, totally secure government network to replace the tainted Internet and function as a link between U.S. intelligence agencies. To prevent further computer pilfering of government secrets, all sensitive data was relocated to one highly secure location, the newly constructed NSA data bank, the Fort Knox of U.S. intelligence data. Literally millions of the country's most classified photos, tapes, documents, and videos were digitized and transferred to the immense storage facility, and then the hard copies were destroyed. The data bank was protected by a triple-layer power relay and a tiered digital backup system. It was also 214 feet underground to shield it from magnetic fields and possible explosions. Activities within the control room were designated Top Secret Umbra, the country's highest level of security. The secrets of the country had never been safer. This impregnable data bank now housed blueprints for advanced weaponry, witness protection lists, aliases of field agents, detailed analyses and proposals for covert operations. The list was endless. There would be no more black bag jobs damaging U.S. intelligence. Of course, the officers of the NSA realized that stored data had value only if it was accessible. The real coup of the data bank was not getting the classified data off the streets. It was making it accessible only to the correct people. All stored information had a security rating and, depending on the level of secrecy, was accessible to government officials on a compartmentalized basis. A submarine commander could dial in and check the NSA's most recent satellite photos of Russian ports, but he would not have access to the plans for an anti-drug mission in South America. CIA analysts could access histories of known assassins, but could not access launch codes reserved for the president. SysSecs, of course, had no clearance for the information in the databank, but they were responsible for its safety. Like all large databanks, from insurance companies to universities, the NSA facility was constantly under attack by computer hackers trying to sneak a peek at the secrets waiting inside. But the NSA security programmers were the best in the world. No one had ever come close to infiltrating the NSA data bank, and the NSA had no reason to think anybody ever would. Inside the SysSec lab, Chartroukian broke into a sweat trying to decide whether to leave. Trouble in translator meant trouble in the data bank, too. Strathmore's lack of concern was bewildering. Everyone knew that translator and the NSA main data bank were inextricably linked. Each new code, once broken, was fired from crypto through 450 yards of fiber optic cable to the NSA databank for safekeeping. The sacred storage facility had limited points of entry, and Translator was one of them. Gauntlet was supposed to be the impregnable threshold guardian, and Strathmore had bypassed it. Chartroukian could hear his own heart pounding. Translator's been stuck 18 hours. The thought of a computer virus entering Translator and then running wild in the basement of the NSA proved too much. "I've got to report this," he blurted aloud. In a situation like this, Chartroukian knew there was only one person to call, the NSA's senior SysSec officer, the short-fused 400-pound computer guru who had built Gauntlet. His nickname was Jabba. He was a demigod at the NSA, roaming the halls, putting out virtual fires, and cursing the feeble-mindedness of the inept and the ignorant. Chartroukian knew that as soon as Jabba heard Strathmore had bypassed Gauntlet's filters, all hell would break loose. Too bad, he thought. I've got a job to do. He grabbed the phone and dialed Jabba's 24-hour cellular. Chapter 45. David Becker wandered aimlessly down Avenida del Cid and tried to collect his thoughts. Muted shadows played on the cobblestones beneath his feet. The vodka was still with him. Nothing about his life seemed in focus at the moment. His mind drifted back to Susan, wondering if she'd gotten his phone message yet. Up ahead, a Seville transit bus screeched to a halt in front of a bus stop. Becker looked up. The bus's doors cranked open, but no one disembarked. The diesel engine roared back to life, but just as the bus was pulling out, three teenagers appeared out of a bar up the street and ran after it, yelling and waving. The engines wound down again, and the kids hurried to catch up. 30 yards behind them, Becker stared in utter incredulity. His vision was suddenly focused, but he knew what he was seeing was impossible. It was a one-in-a-million chance. I'm hallucinating. But as the bus doors opened, the kids crowded around to board. Becker saw it again. This time, he was certain. Clearly illuminated in the haze of the corner streetlight, he'd seen her. The passengers climbed on, and the bus's engines revved up again. Becker suddenly found himself at a full sprint, the bizarre image fixed in his mind. Black lipstick, wild eyeshadow, and that hair, spiked straight up in three distinctive spires, red, white, and blue. As the bus started to move, Becker dashed up the street into a wake of carbon monoxide.
Espera!
He called, running behind the bus. Becker's Cordovan loafers skimmed the pavement. His usual squash agility was not with him, though. He felt off balance. His brain was having trouble keeping track of his feet. He cursed the bartender and his jet lag. The bus was one of Seville's older diesels, and fortunately for Becker, first gear was a long, arduous climb. Becker felt the gap closing. He knew he had to reach the bus before it downshifted. The twin tailpipes choked out a cloud of thick smoke as the driver prepared to drop the bus into second gear. Becker strained for more speed. As he surged even with the rear bumper, Becker moved right, racing up beside the bus. He could see the rear doors, and as on all Seville buses, it was propped wide open. Cheap air conditioning. Becker fixed his sights on the opening and ignored the burning sensation in his legs. The tires were beside him, shoulder high, humming at a higher and higher pitch every second. He surged toward the door, missing the handle and almost losing his balance. He pushed harder. Underneath the bus, the clutch clicked as the driver prepared to change gears.
He's shifting. I won't make it.
But as the engine cogs disengaged to align the larger gears, the bus let up ever so slightly. Becker lunged. The engine re-engaged just as his fingertips curled around the door handle. Becker's shoulder almost ripped from its socket as the engine dug in, catapulting him up onto the landing. David Becker lay collapsed just inside the vehicle's doorway. The pavement raced by only inches away. He was now sober. His legs and shoulders ached. Wavering, he stood, steadied himself, and climbed into the darkened bus. In the crowd of silhouettes only a few seats away were the three distinctive spikes of hair.
Red, white, and blue. I made it.
Becker's mind filled with images of the ring, the waiting Learjet 60, and at the end of it all, Susan. As Becker came even with the girl's seat, wondering what to say to her, the bus passed beneath a streetlight. The punk's face was momentarily illuminated. Becker stared in horror. The makeup on her face was smeared across a thick stubble. She was not a girl at all, but a young man. He wore a silver stud in his upper lip, a black leather jacket, and no shirt.
"What the fuck do you want?"
the hoarse voice asked. His accent was New York. With the disorientated nausea of a slow-motion freefall, Becker gazed at the busload of passengers staring back at him. They were all punks. At least half of them had red, white, and blue hair.
"Siéntate!"
the driver yelled. Becker was too dazed to hear.
"Siéntate!"
the driver screamed.
"Sit down!"
Becker turned vaguely to the angry face in the rearview mirror, but he had waited too long. Annoyed, the driver slammed down hard on the brakes. Becker felt his weight shift. He reached for a seat back but missed. For an instant, David Becker was airborne. Then he landed hard on the gritty floor. On Avenida del Cid, a figure stepped from the shadows. He adjusted his wire-rim glasses and peered after the departing bus. David Becker had escaped, but it would not be for long. Of all the buses in Seville, Mr. Becker had just boarded the infamous number 27. Bus 27 had only one destination. Chapter 46. Phil Chartroukian slammed down his receiver. Jabba's line was busy. Jabba spurned call waiting as an intrusive gimmick that was introduced by AT&T to increase profits by connecting every call. The simple phrase, "I'm on the other line, I'll call you back," made phone companies millions annually. Jabba's refusal of call waiting was his own brand of silent objection to the NSA's requirement that he carry an emergency cellular at all times. Chartroukian turned and looked out at the deserted crypto floor. The hum of the generators below sounded louder every minute. He sensed that time was running out. He knew he was supposed to leave, but from out of the rumble beneath Crypto, the SysSec mantra began playing in his head. Act first. Explain later. In the high-stakes world of computer security, minutes often meant the difference between saving a system or losing it. There was seldom time to justify a defensive procedure before taking it. SysSecs were paid for their technical expertise and their instinct. Act first. Explain later. Chartroukian knew what he had to do. He also knew that when the dust settled, he would be either an NSA hero or in the unemployment line. The great decoding computer had a virus. Of that, the SysSec was certain. There was one responsible course of action. Shut it down. Chartroukian knew there were only two ways to shut down Translator. One was the commander's private terminal, which was locked in his office. Out of the question. The other was the manual kill switch located on one of the sublevels beneath the crypto floor. Chartroukian swallowed hard. He hated the sublevels. He'd only been there once during training. It was like something out of an alien world with its long mazes of catwalks, freon ducts, and a dizzy 136-foot drop to the rumbling power supplies below. It was the last place he felt like going, and Strathmore was the last person he felt like crossing. But duty was duty. They'll thank me tomorrow, he thought, wondering if he was right. Taking a deep breath, Chartroukian opened the senior SysSec's metal locker. On a shelf of disassembled computer parts, hidden behind a media concentrator and a LAN tester, was a Stanford alumni mug. Without touching the rim, he reached inside and lifted out a single Medico key. It's amazing, he grumbled. What system security officers don't know about security. Chapter 47. $1 billion code? Midge snickered, accompanying Brinkerhoff back up the hallway. That's a good one. I swear it, he said. She eyed him askance. This better not be some ploy to get me out of this dress. Midge, I would never, he said self-righteously. I know, Chad. Don't remind me. 30 seconds later, Midge was sitting in Brinkerhoff's chair and studying the crypto report. See? He said, leaning over her and pointing to the figure in question. This MCD? $1 billion. Midge chuckled. It does appear to be a touch on the high side, doesn't it? Yeah, he groaned. Just a touch. Looks like a divide by zero.
A who?
A divide by zero, she said, scanning the rest of the data. The MCD is calculated as a fraction. Total expense divided by number of decryptions.
Of course. Brinkerhoff nodded blankly and tried not to peer down the front of her dress.
When the denominator's zero, Midge explained, the quotient goes to infinity. Computers hate infinity, so they type all nines. She pointed to a different column. See this?
Yeah.
Brinkerhoff refocused on the paper. It's today's raw production data. Take a look at the number of decryptions. Brinkerhoff dutifully followed her finger down the column. Number of decryptions. Zero. Midge tapped on the figure. It's just as I suspected. Divide by zero. Brinkerhoff arched his eyebrows.
So everything's okay?
She shrugged. Just means we haven't broken any codes today. Translator must be taking a break.
A break?
Brinkerhoff looked doubtful. He'd been with the director long enough to know that breaks were not part of his preferred modus operandi, particularly with respect to Translator. Fontaine had paid $2 billion for the code-breaking behemoth, and he wanted his money's worth. Every second Translator sat idle was money down the toilet.
Midge, Brinkerhoff said, Translator doesn't take any breaks. It runs day and night, you know that.
She shrugged. Maybe Strathmore didn't feel like hanging out last night to prepare the weekend run. He probably knew Fontaine was away and ducked out early to go fishing.
Come on, Midge. Brinkerhoff gave her a disgusted look. Give the guy a break.
It was no secret Midge Milken didn't like Trevor Strathmore. Strathmore had attempted a cunning maneuver rewriting Skipjack, but he'd been caught. Despite Strathmore's bold intentions, the NSA had paid dearly. The EFF had gained strength, Fontaine had lost credibility with Congress, and worst of all, the agency had lost a lot of its anonymity. There were suddenly housewives in Minnesota complaining to America Online and Prodigy that the NSA might be reading their email, like the NSA gave a damn about a secret recipe for candied yams. Strathmore's blunder had cost the NSA, and Midge felt responsible. Not that she could have anticipated the commander's stunt, but the bottom line was that an unauthorized action had taken place behind Director Fontaine's back, a back Midge was paid to cover. Fontaine's hands-off attitude made him susceptible, and it made Midge nervous. But the director had learned long ago to stand back and let smart people do their jobs. That's exactly how he handled Trevor Strathmore.
"Midge, you know damn well Strathmore's not slacking," Brinkerhoff argued. "He runs Translator like a fiend."
Midge nodded. Deep down, she knew that accusing Strathmore of shirking was absurd. The commander was as dedicated as they came. Dedicated to a fault. He bore the evils of the world as his own personal cross. The NSA's skipjack plan had been Strathmore's brainchild. A bold attempt to change the world. Unfortunately, like so many divine quests, this crusade ended in crucifixion.
"Okay," she admitted, "so I'm being a little harsh."
"A little?" Brinkerhoff's eyes narrowed. "Strathmore's got a backlog of files a mile long. He's not about to let Translator sit idle for a whole weekend."
"Okay, okay," Midge sighed. "My mistake."
She furrowed her brow and puzzled why Translator hadn't broken any codes all day.
"Let me double-check something," she said, and began flipping through the report.
She located what she was looking for and scanned the figures. After a moment, she nodded.
"You're right, Chet. Translator's been running full force. Raw consumables are even a little on the high side. We're at over 500,000 kilowatt-hours since midnight last night."
"So where does that leave us?"
Midge was puzzled. "I'm not sure. It's odd."
"You want to rerun the data?"
She gave him a disapproving stare.
There were two things one never questioned about Midge Milken. One of them was her data. Brinkerhoff waited while Midge studied the figures.
"Huh," she finally grunted. "Yesterday's stats look fine. 237 codes broken.
MCD, $874. Average time per code, a little over 6 minutes. Raw consumables, average. Last code entering translator..." She stopped.
"What is it?"
"That's funny," she said. "Last file on yesterday's Q-log ran at 11:37 p.m.
"So?"
"So translator breaks codes every 6 minutes or so. The last file of the day usually runs closer to midnight. It sure doesn't look like..."
Midge suddenly stopped short and gasped.
Brinkerhoff jumped.
"What?"
Midge was staring at the readout in disbelief.
"This file? The one that entered translator last night?"
"Yeah."
"It hasn't broken yet. Its queue time was 23:37:08. But it lists no decrypt time."
Midge fumbled with the sheets.
"Yesterday or today?"
Brinkerhoff shrugged.
"Maybe those guys are running a tough diagnostic."
Midge shook her head.
18 hours tough?"
She paused.
"Not likely. Besides, the Q data says it's an outside file. We should call Strathmore."
"At home?" Brinkerhoff swallowed. "On a Saturday night?"
"No," Midge said. "If I know Strathmore, he's on top of this. I'll bet good money he's here. Just a hunch."
Midge's hunches were the other thing one never questioned.
"Come on," she said, standing up. "Let's see if I'm right."
Brinkerhoff followed Midge to her office, where she sat down and began to work Big Brother's keypads like a virtuoso pipe organist. Brinkerhoff gazed up at the array of closed-caption video monitors on her wall, their screens all freeze frames of the NSA seal.
"You're gonna snoop crypto?" he asked nervously.
"Nope," Midge replied. "Wish I could, but crypto's a sealed deal. It's got no video, no sound, no nothing. Strathmore's orders. All I've got is approach stats and basic translator stuff. We're lucky we've even got that."
Strathmore wanted total isolation, but Fontaine insisted on the basics.
Brinkerhoff looked puzzled.
Crypto hasn't got video?
Why? She asked, without turning from her monitor. You and Carmen looking for a little more privacy?
Brinkerhoff grumbled something inaudible. Midge typed some more keys.
I'm pulling Strathmore's elevator log.
She studied her monitor a moment, then rapped her knuckle on the desk.
He's here, she said, matter-of-factly. He's in crypto right now.
Look at this. Talk about long hours. He went in yesterday morning, bright and early, and his elevator hasn't budged since. I'm showing no Magno card use for him on the main door, so he's definitely in there.
Brinkerhoff breathed a slight sigh of relief.
So, if Strathmore's in there, everything's okay, right?
Midge thought a moment.
Maybe, she finally decided.
Maybe?
We should call him and double-check.
Brinkerhoff groaned.
Midge, he's the deputy director. I'm sure he has everything under control. Let's not second-guess...
Oh, come on, Chad. Don't be such a child. We're just doing our jobs. We've got a snag in the stats, and we're following up.
Besides, she added, I'd like to remind Strathmore that Big Brother's watching. Make him think twice before planning any more of his harebrained stunts to save the world.
Midge picked up the phone and began dialing. Brinkerhoff looked uneasy.
You really think you should bother him?
I'm not bothering him, Midge said, tossing him the receiver.
You are.
Chapter 48.
What?
Midge sputtered in disbelief.
Strathmore claims our data is wrong?
Brinkerhoff nodded and hung up the phone.
Strathmore denied that translator's been stuck on one file for 18 hours?
He was quite pleasant about the whole thing,
Brinkerhoff beamed, pleased with himself for surviving the phone call.
He assured me translator was working fine, said it was breaking codes every 6 minutes even as we speak. Thanked me for checking up on him.
He's lying, Midge snapped. I've been running these crypto stats for 2 years. The data is never wrong.
First time for everything, he said casually.
She shot him a disapproving look.
I run all data, twice.
Well, you know what they say about computers. When they screw up, at least they're consistent about it.
Midge spun and faced him.
This isn't funny, Chad. The DDO just told a blatant lie to the director's office. I want to know why.
Brinkerhoff suddenly wished he hadn't called her back in. Strathmore's phone call had set her off. Ever since Skipjack, whenever Midge had a sense that something suspicious was going on, she made an eerie transition from flirt to fiend. There was no stopping her until she sorted it out.
Midge, it is possible our data is off, Brinkerhoff said firmly. I mean, think about it. A file that ties up translator for 18 hours? It's unheard of. Go home, it's late.
She gave him a haughty look and tossed the report on the counter.
I trust the data. Instinct says it's right.
Brinkerhoff frowned. Not even the director questioned Midge Milken's instincts anymore. She had an uncanny habit of always being right.
Something's up, she declared, and I intend to find out what it is.
Chapter 49. Becker dragged himself off the floor of the bus and collapsed in an empty seat.
Nice move, dipshit, the kid with the three spikes sneered.
Becker squinted in the stark lighting. It was the kid he'd chased onto the bus. He glumly surveyed the sea of red, white, and blue coiffures.
What's with the hair? Becker moaned, motioning to the others. It's all red, white, and blue,
the kid offered. Becker nodded, trying not to stare at the infected perforation in the kid's upper lip.
Judas Taboo, the kid said matter-of-factly.
Becker looked bewildered. The punk spit in the aisle, obviously disgusted with Becker's ignorance.
Judas Taboo, greatest punk since Sid Vicious, blew his head off here a year ago today. It's his anniversary.
Becker nodded vaguely, obviously missing the connection.
Taboo did his hair this way the day he signed off. The kid spit again. Every fan worth his weight in piss has got red, white, and blue hair today.
For a long moment, Becker said nothing. Slowly, as if he'd been shot with a tranquilizer, he turned and faced front. Becker surveyed the group on the bus. Every last one was a punk. Most were staring at him.
Every fan has red, white, and blue hair today,
Becker reached up and pulled the driver alert cord on the wall. It was time to get off. He pulled again. Nothing happened. He pulled a third time, more frantically. Nothing.
They disconnect them on bus 27.
The kid spat again.
So we don't fuck with them.
Becker turned. You mean I can't get off? The kid laughed.
Not till the end of the line.
5 minutes later, the bus was barreling along an unlit Spanish country road. Becker turned to the kid behind him.
Is this thing ever going to stop?
The kid nodded.
Few more miles.
Where are we going? He broke into a sudden wide grin.
You mean you don't know?
Becker shrugged. The kid started laughing hysterically.
Oh, shit, you're gonna love it.
Chapter 50. Only yards from Translator's hull, Phil Chartrukian stood over a patch of white lettering on the crypto floor. Crypto sublevels, authorized personnel only. He knew he was definitely not authorized personnel. He shot a quick glance up at Strathmore's office. The curtains were still pulled. Chartrukian had seen Susan Fletcher go into the bathrooms, so he knew she wasn't a problem. The only other question was Hale. He glanced toward Node 3, wondering if the cryptographer were watching.
Fuck it, he grumbled.
Below his feet, the outline of a recessed trapdoor was barely visible in the floor. Chartrukian palmed the key he'd just taken from the SysSec lab. He knelt down, inserted the key in the floor, and turned. The bolt beneath clicked. Then he unscrewed the large external butterfly latch and freed the door. Checking once again over his shoulder, he squatted down and pulled. The panel was small, only 3 feet by 3 feet, but it was heavy. When it finally opened, the SysSec stumbled back. A blast of hot air hit him in the face. It carried with it the sharp bite of Freon gas. Billows of steam swirled out of the opening, illuminated by the red utility lighting below. The distant hum of the generators became a rumble. Chartrukian stood up and peered into the opening. It looked more like the gateway to hell than a service entrance for a computer. A narrow ladder led to a platform under the floor. Beyond that, there were stairs. But all he could see was swirling red mist. Greg Hale stood behind the one-way glass of Node 3. He watched as Phil Chartrukian eased himself down the ladder toward the sublevels. From where Hale was standing, the SysSec's head appeared to have been severed from his body and left out on the crypto floor. Then slowly, it sank into the swirling mist.
Gutsy move, Hale muttered.
He knew where Chartrukian was headed. An emergency manual abort of Translator was a logical action if he thought the computer had a virus. Unfortunately, it was also a sure way to have crypto crawling with SysSec in about 10 minutes. Emergency actions raised alert flags at the main switchboard. A SysSec investigation of crypto was something Hale could not afford. Hale left Node 3 and headed for the trapdoor. Chartrukian had to be stopped. Chapter 51. Jabba resembled a giant tadpole. Like the cinematic creature for whom he was nicknamed, the man was a hairless spheroid. As resident guardian angel of all NSA computer systems, Jabba marched from department to department, tweaking, soldering, and reaffirming his credo that prevention was the best medicine. No NSA computer had ever been infected under Jabba's reign. He intended to keep it that way. Jabba's home base was a raised workstation overlooking the NSA's underground ultra-secret databank. It was there that a virus would do the most damage, and there that he spent the majority of his time. At the moment, however, Jabba was taking a break and enjoying pepperoni calzones at the NSA's all-night commissary. He was about to dig into his third when his cellular phone rang.
Go,
he said, coughing as he swallowed a mouthful.
Jabba, a woman's voice cooed. It's Midge.
Data Queen, the huge man gushed. He'd always had a soft spot for Midge Milken. She was sharp, and she was also the only woman Jabba had ever met who flirted with him.
How the hell are you?
No complaints. Jabba wiped his mouth.
You on site?
Yep.
Care to join me for a calzone?
Love to, Jabba, but I'm watching these hips.
Really? He sniggered. Mind if I join you?
You're bad.
You have no idea.
Glad I caught you in, she said. I need some advice.
He took a long swallow of Dr. Pepper.
Shoot.
It might be nothing, Midge said, but my crypto stats turned up something odd. I was hoping you could shed some light.
What you got?
He took another sip.
I've got a report saying Translator's been running the same file for 18 hours and hasn't cracked it.
Jabba sprayed Dr. Pepper all over his calzone.
You what? Any ideas?
He dabbed at his calzone with a napkin.
What report is this? Production report. Basic cost analysis stuff.
Midge quickly explained what she and Brinkerhoff had found.
Have you called Strathmore?
Yes.
He said everything's fine in crypto. Said Translator's running full speed ahead. Said our data's wrong.
Jabba furrowed his bulbous forehead.
So what's the problem?
Your report glitched. Midge did not respond. Jabba caught her drift. He frowned.
You don't think your report glitched?
Correct.
So you think Strathmore's lying?
It's not that, Midge said diplomatically, knowing she was on fragile ground. It's just that my stats have never been wrong in the past. I thought I'd get a second opinion.
Well, Jabba said, I hate to be the one to break it to you, but your data's fried.
You think so?
I'd bet my job on it.
Jabba took a big bite of soggy calzone and spoke with his mouth full. Longest a file has ever lasted inside Translator is 3 hours. That includes diagnostics, boundary probes, everything. Only thing that could lock it down for 18 hours would have to be viral. Nothing else could do it.
Viral? Yeah, some kind of redundant cycle. Something that got into the processors, created a loop, and basically gummed up the works.
Well, she ventured, Strathmore's been in crypto for about 36 hours straight.
Any chance he's fighting a virus?
Jabba laughed.
Strathmore's been in there for 36 hours?
Poor bastard. His wife probably said he can't come home. I hear she's bagging his ass. Midge thought a moment. She'd heard that, too. She wondered if maybe she was being paranoid.
Midge, Jabba wheezed, and took another long drink. If Strathmore's toy had a virus, he would have called me.
Strathmore's sharp, but he doesn't know shit about viruses. Translator's all he's got. First sign of trouble, he would have pressed the panic button. And around here, that means me. Jabba sucked in a long strand of mozzarella.
Besides, there's no way in hell Translator has a virus.
Gauntlet's the best set of package filters I've ever written. Nothing gets through. After a long silence, Midge sighed.
Any other thoughts?
Yep. Your data's fried.
You already said that.
Exactly.
She frowned.
You haven't caught wind of anything? Anything at all?
Jabba laughed harshly.
Midge, listen up. Skipjack sucked. Strathmore blew it, but move on. It's over.
There was a long silence on the line, and Jabba realized he'd gone too far.
Sorry, Midge. I know you took heat over that whole mess.
Strathmore was wrong. I know how you feel about him.
This has nothing to do with Skipjack, she said firmly.
Yeah, sure, Jabba thought.
Listen, Midge, I don't have feelings for Strathmore one way or another. I mean, the guy's a cryptographer. They're basically all self-centered assholes. They need their data yesterday. Every damn file is the one that could save the world.
So what are you saying?
Jabba sighed.
I'm saying Strathmore's a psycho like the rest of them, but I'm also saying he loves Translator more than his own goddamn wife. If there were a problem, he would have called me.
Midge was quiet a long time. Finally, she let out a reluctant sigh.
So you're saying my data's fried?
Jabba chuckled. Is there an echo in here? She laughed.
Look, Midge, drop me a work order. I'll be up on Monday to double-check your machine.
In the meantime, get the hell out of here. It's Saturday night. Go get yourself laid or something.
She sighed. I'm trying, Jabba.
Believe me, I'm trying. Chapter 52 Club Embrujo, Warlock in English, was situated in the suburbs at the end of the number 27 bus line. Looking more like a fortification than a dance club, it was surrounded on all sides by high stucco walls into which were embedded shards of shattered beer bottles, a crude security system preventing anyone from entering illegally without leaving behind a good portion of flesh. During the ride, Becker had resolved himself to the fact that he'd failed. It was time to call Strathmore with the bad news. The search was hopeless. He had done the best he could. Now it was time to go home. But now, gazing out at the mob of patrons pushing their way through the club's entrance, Becker was not so sure his conscience would allow him to give up the search. He was staring at the biggest crowd of punks he'd ever seen. There were coiffures of red, white, and blue everywhere. Becker sighed, weighing his options. He scanned the crowd and shrugged. Where else would she be on a Saturday night? Cursing his good fortune, Becker climbed off the bus. The access to Club Embrujo was a narrow stone corridor. As Becker entered, he immediately felt himself caught up in the inward surge of eager patrons.
Out of my way, faggot!
A human pincushion pawed past him, giving Becker an elbow in the side.
Nice tie!
Someone gave Becker's necktie a hard yank.
Wanna fuck?
A teenage girl stared up at him, looking like something out of Dawn of the Dead. The darkness of the corridor spilled out into a huge cement chamber that reeked of alcohol and body odor. The scene was surreal. A deep mountain grotto in which hundreds of bodies moved as one. They surged up and down, hands pressed firmly to their sides, heads bobbing like lifeless bulbs on top of rigid spines. Crazed souls took running dives off a stage and landed on a sea of human limbs. Bodies were passed back and forth like human beach balls. Overhead, the pulsating strobes gave the whole thing the look of an old, silent movie. On the far wall, speakers the size of minivans shook so deeply that not even the most dedicated dancers could get closer than 30 feet from the pounding woofers. Becker plugged his ears and searched the crowd. Everywhere he looked was another red, white, and blue head. The bodies were packed so closely together that he couldn't see what they were wearing. He saw no hint of a British flag anywhere. It was obvious he'd never be able to enter the crowd without getting trampled. Someone nearby started vomiting.
Lovely, Becker groaned.
He moved off down a spray-painted hallway. The hall turned into a narrow, mirrored tunnel, which opened to an outdoor patio scattered with tables and chairs. The patio was crowded with punk rockers, but to Becker, it was like the gateway to Shangri-La. The summer sky opened up above him, and the music faded away. Ignoring the curious stares, Becker walked out into the crowd. He loosened his tie and collapsed into a chair at the nearest unoccupied table. It seemed like a lifetime since Strathmore's early morning call. After clearing the empty beer bottles from his table, Becker laid his head in his hands.
Just for a few minutes, he thought.
5 miles away, the man in wire-rimmed glasses sat in the back of a Fiat taxi as it raced headlong down a country road.
Embrujo,
he grunted, reminding the driver of their destination. The driver nodded, eyeing his curious new fare in the rearview mirror.
Embrujo, he grumbled to himself. Weirder crowd every night.
Chapter 53 Tokugen Numataka lay naked on the massage table in his penthouse office. His personal masseuse worked out the kinks in his neck. She ground her palms into the fleshy pockets surrounding his shoulder blades, slowly working her way down to the towel covering his backside. Her hands slipped lower, beneath his towel. Numataka barely noticed. His mind was elsewhere. He had been waiting for his private line to ring. It had not. There was a knock at the door.
Enter,
Numataka grunted. The masseuse quickly pulled her hands from beneath the towel. The switchboard operator entered and bowed.
Honored Chairman?
Speak.
The operator bowed a second time.
I spoke to the phone exchange. The call originated from Country Code 1, the United States.
Numataka nodded. This was good news. The call came from the States. He smiled. It was genuine.
Where in the U.S.? He demanded. They're working on it, sir.
Very well. Tell me when you have more. The operator bowed again and left. Numataka felt his muscles relax. Country Code 1. Good news indeed. Chapter 54. Susan Fletcher paced impatiently in the crypto bathroom and counted slowly to 50. Her head was throbbing.
Just a little longer, she told herself. Hale is North Dakota.
Susan wondered what Hale's plans were. Would he announce the passkey? Would he be greedy and try to sell the algorithm? Susan couldn't bear to wait any longer. It was time. She had to get to Strathmore. Cautiously, she cracked the door and peered out at the reflective wall on the far side of Crypto. There was no way to know if Hale was still watching. She'd have to move quickly to Strathmore's office. Not too quickly, of course. She could not let Hale suspect she was on to him. She reached for the door and was about to pull it open when she heard something. Voices. Men's voices. The voices were coming through the ventilation shaft near the floor. She released the door and moved toward the vent. The words were muffled by the dull hum of the generators below. The conversation sounded like it was coming up from the sub-level catwalks. One voice was shrill, angry. It sounded like Phil Chartroukian.
You don't believe me?
The sound of more arguing rose.
We have a virus!
Then the sound of harsh yelling.
We need to call Jabba!
Then there were sounds of a struggle.
Let me go!
The noise that followed was barely human. It was a long, wailing cry of horror, like a tortured animal about to die. Susan froze beside the vent. The noise ended as abruptly as it had begun. Then there was a silence. An instant later, as if choreographed for some cheap horror matinee, the lights in the bathroom slowly dimmed. Then they flickered and went out. Susan Fletcher found herself standing in total blackness. Chapter 55.
You're in my seat, asshole.
Becker lifted his head off his arms. Doesn't anyone speak Spanish in this damn country? Glaring down at him was a short, pimple-faced teenager with a shaved head. Half of his scalp was red and half was purple. He looked like an Easter egg.
I said you're in my seat, asshole.
I heard you the first time, Becker said, standing up. He was in no mood for a fight. It was time to go.
Where'd you put my bottles?
The kid snarled. There was a safety pin in his nose. Becker pointed to the beer bottles he'd set on the ground. They were empty.
They were my fucking empties.
My apologies, Becker said, and turned to go. The punk blocked his way.
Pick 'em up.
Becker blinked, not amused. You're kidding, right? He was a full foot taller and outweighed the kid by about 50 pounds.
Do I fucking look like I'm kidding?
Becker said nothing.
Pick 'em up!
The kid's voice cracked. Becker attempted to step around him, but the teenager blocked his way.
I said fucking pick 'em up!
Stoned punks at nearby tables began turning to watch the excitement.
You don't want to do this, kid, Becker said quietly.
I'm warning you, the kid seethed. This is my table. I come here every night. Now pick 'em up!
Becker's patience ran out. Wasn't he supposed to be in the Smokies with Susan? What was he doing in Spain, arguing with a psychotic adolescent? Without warning, Becker caught the kid under the armpits, lifted him up, and slammed his rear end down on the table.
Look, you runny-nosed little runt. You're going to back off right now, or I'm going to rip that safety pin out of your nose and pin your mouth shut.
The kid's face went pale. Becker held him a moment, then he released his grip. Without taking his eyes off the frightened kid, Becker stooped down, picked up the bottles, and returned them to the table.
What do you say? He asked.
The kid was speechless.
You're welcome, Becker snapped.
This kid's a walking billboard for birth control.
Go to hell,
the kid yelled, now aware of his peers laughing at him.
Asswipe!
Becker didn't move. Something the kid had said suddenly registered. I come here every night. Becker wondered if maybe the kid could help him. I'm sorry, Becker said. I didn't catch your name.
Two-tone,
he hissed, as if he were giving a death sentence.
Two-tone?
Becker mused. Let me guess. Because of your hair?
No shit, Sherlock.
Catchy name. Make that up yourself?
Damn straight, he said proudly. I'm gonna patent it.
Becker scowled. You mean trademark it? The kid looked confused. You'd need a trademark for a name, Becker said, not a patent.
Whatever,
the punk screamed in frustration. The motley assortment of drunken and drugged-out kids at the nearby tables were now in hysterics. Two-Tone stood up and sneered at Becker.
What the fuck do you want from me?
Becker thought a moment. I want you to wash your hair, clean up your language, and get a job. Becker figured it was too much to ask on a first meeting. I need some information, he said.
Fuck you!
I'm looking for someone.
I ain't seen him.
Haven't seen him, Becker corrected as he flagged a passing waitress. He bought two Aguila beers and handed one to Two-Tone. The boy looked shocked. He took a swig of beer and eyed Becker warily.
You hitting on me, mister?
Becker smiled. I'm looking for a girl. Two-Tone let out a shrill laugh.
You sure as hell ain't gonna get any action dressed like that.
Becker frowned. I'm not looking for action. I just need to talk to her. Maybe you could help me find her. Two-Tone set down his beer.
You a cop?
Becker shook his head. The kid's eyes narrowed.
You look like a cop.
Kid, I'm from Maryland. If I were a cop, I'd be a little out of my jurisdiction, don't you think? The question seemed to stump him. My name's David Becker. Becker smiled and offered his hand across the table. The punk recoiled in disgust.
Back off, fag boy.
Becker retracted the hand. The kid sneered.
I'll help you, but it'll cost you.
Becker played along. How much?
$100.
Becker frowned. I've only got pesetas.
Whatever, make it 100 pesetas.
Foreign currency exchange was obviously not one of Two-Tone's fortes. 100 pesetas was about 87 cents.
Deal,
Becker said, rapping his bottle on the table. The kid smiled for the first time.
Deal.
Okay, Becker continued in his hushed tone. I figure the girl I'm looking for might hang out here. She's got red, white, and blue hair. Two-Tone snorted.
It's Judas Tabu's anniversary. Everybody's got...
She's also wearing a British flag T-shirt and has a skull pendant in one ear. A faint look of recognition crossed Two-Tone's face. Becker saw it and felt a surge of hope. But a moment later, Two-Tone's expression turned stern. He slammed his bottle down and grabbed Becker's shirt.
She's Eduardo's, you asshole. I'd watch it. You touch her, and he'll kill you.
This book is continued on Disc 6.